This is Brian Beeler. Thanks for listening to the Storage Review podcast. On today's podcast, I speak with Luke Wignall, who works in the technical performance and engineering team at NVIDIA, specifically with their grid products. Now, before you get too glazed over with the idea of a conversation around VDI, rest assured that this is really interesting stuff. And Luke does a pretty good job of indicating why the enterprise at large should care about VDI, how they can deploy it, some of the use cases, and he dives into a lot of the software engineering they're doing with Citrix and VMware to help bring this in a consumable way to the enterprise. It's a departure from some of the other podcasts that we've done that have been a little more storage heavy, but I think it's a really interesting topic. We continue to expand our lab at Storage Review, and one of those use cases is around measuring virtual workstation performance using the NVIDIA grid cards. We've teamed up with HP and HPE to bring that to realization and look forward to publishing some great data around use cases around Esri and many other applications specific to virtual workstation performance in those environments. With no further delay, let's get to Luke and learn a little bit more about what NVIDIA is up to in the enterprise. Joining us on the podcast today is Luke Wignall from NVIDIA. Luke, thanks for joining.
Yeah, glad to be here.
So Luke, tell us a little bit about your role at NVIDIA and what goes on over there in your department.
Sure. Officially Senior Manager of Performance Engineering and Tech Marketing. At the Pro, what we call the ProViz org, which is professional visualization. And a big piece of that, along with Quadro and other, you know, VR and other magic, is Grid, which is our GPU in the cloud offering.
So you know, we've worked with you guys for a while now on GPUs in the enterprise. And I think that so often they're thought of as something in the HPC space or something on some fringe use cases around desktop virtualization. But as you're growing this and continuing to expand the offering, is there a way to better characterize what NVIDIA is doing in the enterprise?
It's funny, complicated question, mostly because NVIDIA is now in more different areas of a data center than ever before. Enterprises are, you know, you mentioned high-performance computing, right? HPC is and our Tesla product has been a bastion for quite some time. Quadro, which would be the professional workstation, the hallmark of anybody doing professional visualization on a physical workstation, 80 to 90% of the market uses Quadro, for example. But then anytime you start, you know, really digging into just how capable is a GPU from a hardware perspective, and then just what sort of goodness is NVIDIA delivering with the software that they layer on top of that. And we're everything from autonomous driving cars to artificial intelligence and deep learning, you know, deep neural networks. We are, and of course, Grid, which is an area of my focus, and that's the ability to deliver fantastic user experience, whether it's professional visualization, you know, that same user that would have been using Quadro, or whether it's a business PC user who, you know, with today's graphics, with things like, you know, Microsoft Office requiring or not requiring, but certainly performing a heck of a lot better with hardware acceleration, GPU acceleration, any user now can take advantage of this. And we're really in all those different categories. So NVIDIA is a great place to be right now.
Yeah, it sounds like quite a bit of fun over there. So when we think about Grid specifically and virtual desktops, I think a lot of people have this vision of VDI being, like a call center with a few hundred employees that come and go on regular shifts and don't need a lot of access to software and applications, or, you know, the medical professionals that bounce around rooms and want to have their profiles follow them. But VDI is much more than that, I know, just from working with you directly and some of the things that we're doing from a test lab standpoint around what I like to call virtual workstation, which implies a little bit more beef to the deliverable. How are you guys thinking about the VDI space specifically then, and what you do with Grid, and how an enterprise should be thinking about that particular bit of the business being segmented?
Well, you know, certainly if somebody required, I mean, you know, the simplest possible answer on the virtual workstation side was, you know, if you needed a GPU in your physical workstation, you got to have a GPU in your virtual workstation. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about this, and the apps that they're doing, the workloads that they're doing, just simply require that sort of horsepower and that sort of capability. But I think to just simply talk about that virtual workstation piece denies the fact that, and you mentioned task workers, there really is no user group I'm aware of at this point that would be willing to have even a mediocre user experience, right? I mean, everybody wants to have a great user experience. And this isn't a world anymore that doesn't have graphics involved. And I actually want to jump back to your task worker comment, because many, many, many moons ago, when I was a consultant, I used to own an integrator in the Rocky Mountain region, and we were actually doing work for a call center that was, and this is long before, this is years ago, but what was interesting at the time, this has really stuck with me as a lesson, is that that call center, which handled, I think it was cell phone billing or something. So, you know, it's AT&T, it's Sprint, it's whoever this is engaging with this provider. But every one of the desktops that they were trying to deliver at the time, we were there to do a virtual desktop implementation. Every one of the desktops they were trying to deliver, those desktops were delivering web-enabled apps to these task workers. And the task workers were being judged on speed and ability to complete their tasks quickly. And most of their apps being web delivered were predominantly, frankly, fairly graphical. You know, picture tells 1,000 words, right? So if I can throw a graphical thing in front of a task worker and they can move that much faster through their workflow, then that person's getting more work done faster. I'm able to hit my service delivery requirements, et cetera. I think we dismiss that as being, oh, those are task workers. They don't, you know, they don't need acceleration. They don't need a better user experience, or they can get by with less. Let's just put it that way. And it's patently not true. And so if you go from that end of, you know, that extreme, if you will, to the other extreme, which is maybe a high-end designer who actually is looking for the extreme level of performance, which is both HPC, that compute aspect, as well as the graphical demands of a 3D design application. Say this is media entertainment, they're working in Maya. Maya also could be found in AEC, architecture, engineering, and construction firms, as well as manufacturing, right? For photorealistic rendering is a product that they're defining, whether it's a car, whether it's a building that you're architecting. And they're looking for a combination of both high-end 3D design as well as the ability to do render and compute jobs with that data set. That's two different GPU activities. And they want to do it from a single cloud-delivered instance, something we support as well. So really both extremes, and that's the enterprise story, right? It's a solution, a single platform that we can deliver that handles from one end to the other of an enterprise.
Well, help me out with this higher-end space, the engineer, the M&E professional, because it seems to me, just outside looking in, that those guys aren't going to be raising their hands saying, you know, this $10,000 desktop I have or whatever it is, go ahead and take that away and deliver me a virtual desktop instead. So assuming that's the case, what's driving the proof of concepts and ultimately the deployments at the higher end of the space for virtual workstation?
HR, that's the first one that pops into my head, strangely. HR in the sense that I want to be able to hire talent from wherever that talent lives. We've heard this from car manufacturers in the Midwest that are struggling to get people to move to where their headquarters are from places that maybe aren't upper Midwest weather. Let's just put it that way. they want to hire where that talent is, and they don't want to be limited to having to hire in a geographical location. Another one would be mergers and acquisitions, right? Or even smaller firms looking to be much larger. You have a small, I have an AEC firm, Populous, that's been talked about heavily. We have a lot of references around them because I think they have maybe 500 employees, and yet they won the Olympic Stadium in London, the London Olympics, out, you know, they beat out massive, globally recognized firms for that job, and then beat those same firms again in the refit of the same stadium to repurpose it after the Olympics so that it was usable, just, you know, ongoing. And they did so by appearing much, much larger and by being far more nimble. And that's, you know, these are very high-end workloads, very high-end engineers and so forth that, you know, a larger firm might bring 1,000 of those people to the table. And they were able to just aggregate and collect all the various resources they needed, whether it was subcontractors or partners or whatever, and be able to leverage all the employees that they had in a far more nimble fashion to win the business. So it's that sort of flexibility that I think is, and, you know, keep in mind, from their perspective, they don't need to locate the data all over the place then, right? I mean, I think this is a big piece of this story is you have high-end designers doing high-end work. All right, well, that's the physical workstation part of the story. And maybe there's a, well, we know there's a big Quadro card in there somewhere, right? So that has to be brought into the cloud. But there's also the data side of the story and all the other resources that go into supporting those users. And if I can centralize all that, and I can bring all the compute into wherever that data is, centralize all of that, I can then untether all the users, and they can be anywhere. And they can be remote, they can be on job sites, they could just simply not be working in the place that the data is. And that tells a very compelling story.
Well, the data security is a concern that we hear over and over again that gets amplified by the more geographically dispersed the workforce is. So bringing that and keeping it in the data center and maintaining your current, you know, enterprise policies around data protection starts to become a pretty big issue, right?
Absolutely. I'd give you two different variations of that story. It's more than just, I think, the obvious data security one, which is intellectual property protection. You know, I've designed something, I don't want that design to end up in somebody else's hands, right? Two other versions of that story, though, that I one very business oriented in the sense that this is a top three AEC firm in the world. And their problem is the amount that they have to add to every fixed quote or bid for rework, because data centrality, the lack of data centrality, means that people are working on the wrong version of the drawing potentially, or not getting notified of customer change requests. And so they continue working in the wrong direction. And so there's all this rework. And so whether it's data security from a theft perspective or data security just from a, you know, what, you know, version control, what version are we on? And are we working on the right thing? To another story, which is yet another, I think top five this time, AEC firm, who in a conversation with them, I said, oh yeah, data security, I'm sure that's an issue. Oh yeah, absolutely. We're constantly losing data. And I said, well, that sounds terrible. So data security and people stealing. No, we lose the data. This went on for a few minutes back and forth until he finally said, no, we have drawers full of portable hard drives, thumb drives, you name it. We have no idea where the data goes. It's just, there's no way with in a global company where data movement becomes such an issue that you just don't lose it. And so for them, it was reworked from scratch, right? Or even not being remotely close to the right version. And that actually reminds me of yet another thing. And this one, I want to touch on this because when we start talking about some of these things, it's, you know, obviously the whole TCRI conversation comes up. And we have a challenge in that soft things that would maybe be described as a soft cost, and I would argue maybe shouldn't be, because the math is quite easy, and that's productivity gains by centrally locating that data. So in other words, we have a manufacturer in a southern part of the U.S. Aerospace, and for them, they went from anywhere from 45 minutes to up to 2 hours to open a CATIA file, so having to pull that from one corporate location to another. So this isn't remote at your house or anything like that. This is satellite offices over, you know, enterprise bandwidth. But it would take them 45 minutes to in some cases hours to be able to pull that data and open it and interact with it and then repeat that process to put the data back. And so for them, they were able to save in the neighborhood of anywhere from as little as 5.5 hours per engineer per week just in data transfer time. To as much in some cases of a full man day or more of time that's potentially saved just from a productivity standpoint. So if you take that times the number of working weeks in a year times that salary of that individual or billing rate or however you determine your revenue stream for that individual. And we're talking millions and millions of dollars. I mean, these are not trivial values, and yet they get described as soft costs.
Yeah, I mean, clearly the benefits to the enterprise make a lot of sense. For the end user, though, until you've tried it, is there any other way to convince the end user that this is a viable way for them to go forward from a compute perspective?
Well, you made the comment before, and I'm not sure I touched on it maybe enough, and that's the how do you pry the big glorious workstation out of an engineer or designer's, warm pink hands. I think you're going to find as you talk to customers, or as customers maybe talk to a peer or another customer that's maybe further along in the BDI process, you're going to find that when you start allowing people, take those engineers in that satellite office, if I can go from 45 minutes to an hour or more down to 4 minutes or whatever it is I'm saving, right? Huge differences in time. Users don't want to sit there and stare at a task bar going by. I mean, it's a complete and total waste of their time, right? They want to feel productive. They want to get work done. From an employee morale perspective, we see a lot of wins. But sometimes it's as trivial as trivial to maybe this conversation, but I can guarantee you to this manager, this story I'm going to tell you was not trivial. This manager is celebrating his daughter's birthday. Everybody is over at the house. He gets the call from his boss saying, you got to sign off on a drawing. It's a 45-minute drive to the office. It's, 45 minutes plus to open the file. He's staring at the rest of his day to go sign off on a drawing. This is a true story. And he ended up using BDI. It was still in a POC phase, but it was enough in production that he was able to access his data file. And he actually opened it up on an iPad. We can all agree that a small iPad is probably not what you're going to do your life CATIA work on, but he was able to open the drawing, view the drawing, edit the drawing, not so much edit, but make a change and make a notation and resubmit it with an approval. I was able to do that in 45 minutes, drawing open and saved in no time at all. And that changed his entire weekend and his daughter's birthday. That you have one of those stories, and 1,000 users come knocking on the door because they want it as well. It really is that way.
So talk to me a little bit. I know this isn't exactly your business, but the consumption side. So you talked about iPad. We've seen the number of and variety of thin clients from Dell and HP and others really exploding in terms of quality of the product they're putting out. There's some great all-in-one solutions. There's some great mobile solutions that are really more impressive, I think, maybe in the last year or two than the five or six beforehand. When you think about the engineering and innovation around thin client itself, what are you guys seeing there, and is that doing anything to aid the adoption?
Absolutely. In fact, it goes back to your previous question, if you will. Users won't adopt this if we continue to push small resolution, single screen, small, very optimized for scalability and host performance, not end user experience performance. If that continues to be what we're trying to deliver, and that's not what we're seeing in these end devices now. We're seeing multiple displays, higher resolution, up to 4K, in fact. We're seeing onboard H.264 decodes so that we're really getting an opportunity to leverage some of the performance enhancements that have come out in recent months, right? The leveraging, thanks to software, now leveraging the already existing hardware functionality of Encode on chip so that you're actually using the hardware acceleration built into the GPU to speed up the Encode process. Well, we need that on the other end, right? On the client side as well. So these more powerful end devices are also delivering a better experience. They play a very significant role in delivering that better end user experience. So if you want evidence of improved and expanded end user adoption, you wouldn't see these end devices increasing in capabilities if the demand being put on them by end users wasn't also increasing.
So that makes quite a bit of sense. One other thing I wanted to hit on, and you've talked about it a little bit, is the consumption model for desktop. There's a couple different strategies. Dell has, for instance, the Precision Appliance. We looked at a review unit earlier this year. They've already refreshed it even. I suppose it's going well for them. which is a really neat way in the data center to put an appliance in and be ready to go with the grid cards installed and the software and everything's all set up. But I know you guys support cloud deployments as well. What are you seeing there in terms of the way your customers are consuming these and deploying them out in the wild?
So cloud, I think there's this, I know earlier this year in a conversation I had, with a known pundit, we got into a bit of a disagreement because at the time he said he didn't believe that enterprise was necessarily ready for the cloud. And I think we've seen just a tremendous move in that direction, maybe more hybrid than, a black and white one or the other approach, certainly. But enterprise is embracing this idea of, if I take everything we've already talked about in terms of flexibility and manageability that VDI brings to what otherwise would have been, a sea of physical workstations on desktops, for example, right? If you look at that and you put it all into a data center that's on-prem, then putting that off-prem is nowhere near the stretch that it was before. Caught off guard myself recently with a customer who announced they were going to switch to a hybrid mode, and the end users they were going to start with, my money would have been on more simple users, lower end, less need, less demand, higher density, maybe something to that effect. And I was operating on the assumption that, you got data, you got all this other, these sort of bigger demands, bigger resources with their largest profiled users, profiles being how we define the size and capability of the amount of shared resource you're delivering to an end user. And it turns out, no, they're putting their most extreme users in the cloud because those are the lowest density, and albeit maybe a more expensive option in the cloud, it keeps them from having to create these dedicated resources internally on-prem. They can instead have the flexibility in the cloud and have bigger bandwidth for more, if you think about the amount of bandwidth pipeline that goes into these data centers, these big cloud providers, for them, it meant a really nice SLA. They knew they would have more consistent uptime and capability, better bandwidth, and a more simple solution for some of their most demanding users. Did not expect that. Like I said, I was thinking, it'll be the lower end user. We, of course, hear all sorts of startups and so forth that start off looking at cloud, but now with enterprise, we're really beginning to see that exploration into more and more user types in the cloud.
That's interesting to hear, and I think that's something that'll continue to grow, I'm sure, as enterprise moves more into even, in the hybrid mode in that direction. One thing I want to also dive into with you is, for me, I think a lot about NVIDIA as a hardware company, the grid card, the physical thing you put in the server. We've talked a little bit in the past about software too, though, and I know you've got some great partners with Citrix and VMware and many, many others, especially on the application side. How do you guys think about NVIDIA's role from a software perspective, and what are you doing to help enable those relationships?
Great question. Historically, you would look at maybe an 18 to 24 month refresh, oddly timed, maybe not so oddly timed, with whatever new Quadro card was being released, right? We'd up the ante. We would put more performance into that Quadro card and, of course, the driver that goes with it. I think there's a myth that our Quadro driver is something that you get for free. And I think if you take the time to size or to price out the difference between, say, a consumer-level GeForce card, albeit still a tremendously powerful card, it is simply architected for a different use case. When you begin to look at what's required of a Quadro user or for a Quadro user, what is it that a Quadro user demands? And that is stability, enterprise tested. They're looking for things like greater uptime, greater consistency out of the hardware. They're looking for far more stable and easy to support and maintain long branch drivers. That's a very, just if we stop there, this is a very different customer than a GeForce customer. And Quadro cards, what's involved in their value is not just far more durable enterprise class hardware, but also far more stable and thorough tested enterprise software in the form of the driver, inside that driver is also a tremendous amount of work with our ISVs, you know, whether it's, you know, it could be Autodesk, for example, it could be Dassault. We have, you know, if you go look, there's thousands of apps, there's hundreds of ISVs who we've worked closely with on the Quadro side to build performance and feature capability enhancements within the software stack so that that hardware performs very differently in a Quadro environment than anything would in the non-Quadro environment. That none of that can be dismissed. That's a tremendous amount of value that you'll, if you talk to any Quadro customer, they demand it. They're used to it. They've tested it. And if you talk to the ISVs, they want it because they know that their app gets the best possible, delivers the best possible experience to that customer with greater consistency than any other solution. What we've done with the grid side is we've now added an ability to stretch out that lifespan, be able to deliver more features and benefit via software on top of a far longer, more consistent hardware platform, because we've gone to the Tesla card as our underlying hardware. Tesla is something that's designed to run 24/7 in a data center. Now, on top of that, we're adding software bits such as the vGPU manager, something that is actually embedded within, as a micro hypervisor, within the hypervisors of both Citrix and VMware. So these are tight integrations with these partners. And as a result, we have tremendous performance and stability out of these solutions. If you do the comparison to some of our competitors, for example, you see us scale out far better with far more consistent performance. And, you know, frankly, the way we do our time slicing with the way we've embedded ourselves in these hypervisors to take advantage of the same sorts of behaviors from end users, you actually see far better performance with us than you would anybody else, because you get undivided use during your time slice of that GPU. Recent examples, I mean, there's a ton of this stuff going on right now, but recent examples would be the NVENC code that I mentioned before, NVENC as we call it, released in at GTC in the spring with VMware, and just recently in August with Citrix. All they did was add software, working with us, added capability. If you were already an M60 or an M10 owner, and you had those cards in your servers, by simply upgrading software, you enhanced, in some cases, take latency alone, 51 milliseconds of increased performance. So that's reduction in latency by the use of NVENC. Software upgrade, no change in your hardware, and suddenly you were 51 milliseconds in internet time. That is a huge improvement and latency closer to your desktop. So in terms of end user performance, end user experience, and thus end user happiness, you give an end user 51 milliseconds snappier experience and they will love you.
Well, we often get asked about the benefits of certain technologies, be it flash or more RAM or better CPUs. And when you get to the end user, the question is often, does it feel faster, right? Because we can benchmark the heck out of anything. And just because something is 10 seconds faster or 30% better, it doesn't always translate into perceived experience. So a lot of what you're talking about is the end user feeling the benefit. 51 milliseconds is pretty substantial in that case.
Yeah, let me speak a little more to that. And this is always it's hard, right? This isn't the sort of technical thing you can turn into a soundbite necessarily. But if you take a standard desktop, any desktop, no networking involved, you're just sitting at your desktop, you're creating it could be a Word doc, it could be a PowerPoint, and you hit the letter K, K is going to appear on your PowerPoint or what have you. The round trip time that it takes to push that key and have that letter appear and your eyes see it, averages about 65 milliseconds. And people don't appreciate that that in and of itself is a journey that has to happen, you know, over the bus, you know, from the keyboard, all the way through till it hits, you know, becomes photons and appears on your screen. Now, when I talk to most people, I talk about latency, they immediately jump to ping times and they say, oh, well, you know, we've got a team that's based overseas. They have a 150 millisecond latency and I'd love to improve that. Well, on top of that 150 milliseconds, you need to factor in that, say, 65 milliseconds of local round trip time, right? On average, if we were to go to our game streaming as an example, where latency is, if you want to talk about people that are really demanding, you take a gamer who's dealing with a first-person shooter and you give them some latency and they do not like you. and in the case of an engineer or an architect or somebody, if you grab the edge of that car model, whatever they're working on, and you go to grab it, it feels like it's attached by a rubber band, right? It's just got that sort of real slack kind of spongy feel to it. I think Jensen was the one that referred to it as spongy. And they don't like you. So that sponginess is all latency, and that latency is part of that entire journey. So while we may not be able to improve, obviously can't currently improve your WAN connectivity, so that ping time of 150 milliseconds, if on the other hand, I can knock 50 milliseconds off the rest of that path, that's as though your ping time was just dropped from 150 down to 100. That's a massive increase in speed in terms of end user feel. And it's worth noting that latency and snappiness go hand in hand. End user experience and end user acceptance of that experience, snappiness is really what they all go by. Skipping frames and things locking up and freezing are obvious. But once you've solved all that, then you're down to that snappiness. And that's where the judging really begins with an end user, once you've sort of optimized everything else. And if we can knock 50 milliseconds off of a journey, and in some cases with some of these older protocol types, we're actually knocking up to 150 milliseconds off that round trip journey. And in fact, recent testing with NVENC, we're in H.264, we're actually down to about 100 to 120 millisecond round trip journey on a standard, local area network. We're going to make a first person shooter happy at this point, right? So this is the work that's going on. These are the sorts of things that we're trying to really focus on, with end users being, the key thing that we're trying to make happy here.
We talked about the media and entertainment space, talked a lot about design use cases as well. Is there anything else within the mainstream enterprise where this makes virtual desktop makes itself a good play? If we get past just some of the more obvious use cases, is there anything else that listeners can be thinking about as they plan out their next buys of equipment, or maybe they think, well, I've got a clump of users, maybe this virtual thing works out. What should they be thinking about?
Well, I think there's no way to even have that conversation without touching on near future, which is Windows 10. Windows 10 in our tests has shown to require somewhere in the vicinity of between 200 and 300 megabytes of frame buffer to perform well. Can you optimize, and I'm doing the hanging finger quotes here about optimize, can you optimize it by turning as much as you possibly can off in order to reduce the amount of resource demand? Sure. Will end users appreciate that? No. And I use the if a tree falls in the forest joke and say, if you build a massive VDI deployment and no users show up, have you built anything? It's Windows 10, Office 2016. In fact, we ran Windows 10 with the Login VSI knowledge worker workload, and those two combined demand over 512 meg of frame buffer, meaning we're already in the land of 1 gig of frame buffer to provide end user experience. Why do I bring this up? Because again, when you look at the entire array of user types that an enterprise needs to satisfy, as you're looking at the refresh rate of high-end workstations, I think it's a no-brainer to look at Grid, because we actually save tremendous amounts of money compared to the expense of those physical workstations, and you have all the flexibility and ability to grow over time without having to incur, that refresh hardware cost. But at the virtual PC level, the business PC level, there's no reason not to have that same conversation, because you still have refresh rates, you still have an increase in hardware requirement coming thanks to Windows 10 no matter what. Why wouldn't you look at all the efficiency and manageability that comes from, sort of the hallmark value prop of virtualization, whether it's Citrix or VMware, and then add on top of that the assurances of a great end user experience? I don't know why anybody would architect without that. So put all that together, and I think enterprises today need to be looking at all the stuff that has been sort of standard fare, but instead of going into this trying to figure out which users can and cannot use VDI, I have yet to see an end user type an app stack that can't at this point, short of some extreme legacy app or, you know, maybe odd peripheral or something, some 9-pin thing. Otherwise, for an enterprise, I would say all your users are valid candidates and take the time, do the analysis, and by being able to spread some of these savings across all these different user types, I think it's a brand new world when it comes to VDI for enterprise.
Luke, I think you did a phenomenal job of summing it up there in your last statement, and I think we leave it at that. I want to thank you for spending the time with us today, for helping get some of the message out there and get us thinking about this as something other than a solution for call centers or very specific use cases. Appreciate the time.
Excellent. I appreciate your time. Thank you much.
I'd like to thank Luke again for participating in the podcast today. Really great information about what NVIDIA is doing in the enterprise. And Luke does a really good job of highlighting where traditional industries can benefit, but also where the enterprise at large can benefit as we think about securing data, minimizing cost, improving user experience, and all of these other things that get bundled up with virtualized desktops. Keep in touch with Storage Review by following us at Storage Review on Twitter. We've got an RSS feed for all of our content and a newsletter coming soon. Let us know what we can do to continue to make our content engaging for you. Reach out to us at info@storagereview.com. Until next time, thank you.